I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In the new opera Crossing, we're alongside Walt Whitman, the wound dresser, in a Civil War battle hospital. This is composer Matt O'Coin's bold leap into the imagination of the fountainhead of American poetry. O'Coin, at 25, 3 years out of Harvard, is finding Whitman at 45 in a sort of midlife crisis. He's gone south in a hurry to find his brother, who's been wounded at Fredericksburg, Virginia. But Whitman is crossing with a purpose, not just into a war zone, but into an oozing, bloody, black and blue pit of amputation and agony after battle. 18,000 men had been killed or wounded in a Confederate victory over 3 days at Fredericksburg. So Whitman has entered a zone of death and dying where quickly he took on his last big mission in poetry to see and write what no one back to Homer had done. In particular, the comradeship, kindness, generosity, the adhesiveness, inescapably the love that surfaces among men at war. For the New Yorker who wrote Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, it's a different sort of crossing, and it's a leap for Matt O'Coin, who took courage knowing that he and the great Walt, for all their differences, are both exuberant devotees of opera, of words and music inseparable. Whitman said that but for the opera he had heard, he could never have written his Leaves of Grass. Matt O'Coin's version is that in Whitman's liberated lines, he grew up hearing melodies surging and spilling over the side of the page.
If in the beginning there was the word, the first time you hear a word, you perceive it as a musical object. Mm. Its sound, its shape, it's a sensual object that accumulates meanings. And what we think of as pure instrumental music, I think, yearns to be speech-like. It strives to take on the clarity and the articulation of words.
There are two stars in this radio hour. Matt O'Coin, wiry little genius, once a little league pitcher from suburban Boston, coming on strong now as poet, pianist, librettist, composer, and conductor. Maybe the next Leonard Bernstein, the Wall Street Journal said a year ago. This year, the Times thought, no, maybe the next Wagner, the great god of the Ring cycle and all of German opera. Matt O'Coin's star is the Whitman we've barely known. Not just Walt Whitman, as he said, an American, one of the roughs, sounding his barbaric yawp over the rooftops of the world. Whitman at midlife is set on reconciling aspects of himself and others, asking, what is it then between us? That is, what is it connecting us and what keeping us apart? Lisa New, who teaches American poetry at Harvard, is going to remind us of the Song of Myself, Whitman, that we all almost know. On the way, actor Ben Evett summons Walt Whitman crossing Brooklyn Ferry.
Flood tide below me, I see you face to face. Clouds of the west, sun there half an hour high, I see you also face to face. Crowds of men and women attired in the usual costumes. How curious you are to me. On the ferry boats the hundreds and hundreds that cross, returning home, are more curious to me than you suppose. And you that shall cross from shore to shore years hence are more to me, and more in my meditations than you might suppose. Others will enter the gates of the ferry and cross from shore to shore. Others will watch the run of the flood tide. Others will see the shipping of Manhattan north and west, and the heights of Brooklyn to the south and east. Others will see the islands, large and small. 50 years hence, others will see them as they cross, the sun half an hour high. 100 years hence, or ever so many hundred years hence, others will see them, will enjoy the sunset, the pouring in of the flood tide, the falling back to the sea of the ebb tide.
That was Ben Evett in a fragment of Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. This is Lisa New.
Well, I think to get to the Whitman of the Civil War, one needs to have some sense of Whitman before the Civil War. This kid who's the son of a house builder in Brooklyn, watching Brooklyn, those four-story brownstones we know, watching all of that go up, learns how to build houses, is with his father one of the, as he'll say later, one of the roughs,
yeah.
Right, is a working man, learns to, you know, work in print shops, and then in a classic kind of leap for the 1840s, goes from being a printer to journalist and eventually to poet. Whitman is a guy exuberant and stimulated by New York City during its most heady period of change. And as he walks the streets of an increasingly crowded and diverse and textured city, he comes into a new sense of self, right? A sense of the I as made out of all of these diverse phenomena. And out of that sense that he's made not only of his own psyche, his own upbringing, but everything he sees on the city streets and all the glances that are attracted to him and that he's made of his commute across the East River from Brooklyn to New York. And he's made, too, out of his body. And selves are made up of their contact and their adhesiveness and their union with all the phenomenon around him.
Then comes the Civil War.
Then comes the Civil War. And Whitman, from the beginning, advocated, rhapsodized, devoted all of his passion and rhetorical energy toward the idea of union. He thought of every individual atom as belonging to every other. He didn't believe in parts so much as the kind of mutual attraction of parts and wholes. He says very famously in Leaves of Grass, these United States are themselves the greatest poem. So that the very idea of a voluntary association of parts was for Whitman just immensely beautiful, just as the idea of mind and body and environment all in a fluent and integrated ecology. The idea of union as an abstract thing was very, very powerful for Whitman. And so in a poem like Beat, Beat Drums, Beat, Beat Drums, Blow, Bugles, Blow, Whitman summons everyone from their individual pursuits and says, time to march to one rhythm. Time to hearken to one sound. And what's amazing about that is that, I mean, I've just mentioned drums and bugles. That's to say that all of human life becomes harmony or art, right? There's a way that war for Whitman is a reorganization of the randomness of human culture into something more artistic. The one most remarkable thing about Leaves of Grass for many who read it was that its form was so radical, it seemed to reject ceremony and formality. And one of the first things that happens with Whitman as Civil War comes is that he becomes more of a formalist. He says, or he begins to think about what is the function of a parade, or a uniform, or a ceremony, or the tapping, the rhythmic tapping of a drum. This was not a rhythmic tapper before. And so Civil War comes, and Whitman hears that his brother George is wounded in December of 1862. And from New York, he goes to find his brother and be with his brother, and he's heard that he's mortally wounded. He later discovers George is okay. George has a somewhat minor wound. He will heal in a few weeks, but in the meantime, making his way to his brother, Whitman is plunged into life on the battlefield. And the discontinuity and the contrast between stately life and the cries and the agony, and also the camaraderie and the tenderness of men living together. I mean, Whitman sees, yes, one of the first sights and one that resonates through Drum Taps is, you know, these piles of amputated limbs. Mm. But quickly, even as he assimilates and becomes a more mature poet, you can see the maturation happening as he attends to suffering. You can also see him observing this new all-male culture of war and beginning to reflect on, gosh, what is, you know, why do men go to war? What is the office, the function of war? Not just war fought for particular aims, but the whole gestalt of war, which includes marching across vast swaths of territory, sometimes in the sunshine, right? War includes beautiful days with your comrades, discovering an American geography that you'd never seen. And one of the things I feel when I read Whitman's Civil War poems, it's as though the American geography is first being encountered. Mm. Like, look at that. Look at that river. Look at how it, in fact, sparkles. It's not encountered in the abstract, and it's not only encountered as territory to be won, but as what it is.
Coming up, Matt O'Coyne, listening for the rediscovered beat of Walt Whitman's war book, Drum Taps. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about Walt Whitman and the Civil War on the occasion of a new opera, Crossing. Critic Harold Bloom observed to me impulsively this spring that his great Walt is holding us close in a place where poetry had not gone before.
Walt Whitman, who is still, I think, not just the most magnificent American poet, but the most magnificent American writer, indeed, I would go further. Lincoln's surely only rival for the greatest American. But I sometimes would put Walt first because of that incredible devotion for years in those horrible things miscalled hospitals, where he labored from morning till night as an unpaid volunteer nurse and wound dresser. What can one say? The overwhelming thing about Walt Whitman is the extraordinary combination of absolute originality on the one hand and the amazing degree of intimacy that he calls out for in his reader. I cannot think of anyone in the entire history of poetry before or after Walt Whitman, who could actually write the following in a little poem called of 1856, to you, whoever you are. Whoever you are, I place my hand upon you that you may be my poem. That's stunning. Whoever you are, I place my hand upon you that you may be my poem. He's always drawing you very close to him. Nobody else does that.
And you shall come.
It is the multidimensional prodigy Matthew O'Coyne who assembled Whitman's words from poems and diaries, then wrote the libretto and composed the songs and the orchestral score for the show being mounted this week with the American Repertory Theater at Harvard. He told us a lot about what drew him to the late Whitman and about the resonance of that word crossing in the title of his opera.
So the opera takes place during his years as a volunteer during the Civil War. He was in his 40s. He'd already published essentially all of his really great poetry. And I started thinking that some kind of midlife crisis must have precipitated the decision to drop everything and volunteer for 3 or 4 years. And I started imagining it as a Dante-esque moment, you know, in the middle of my life. I found that I didn't know myself, and Whitman, like Dante, decides that he needs to go to a kind of hell on earth. The Civil War hospitals were hell on earth to know himself better and to test himself. So I wanted to write the entire opera in this highly pressurized space, which is like purgatory. It's in a war hospital on the outskirts of DC. So not really north, not really south. It's near the end of the war. The country is decentralized. No one's sure what's going on. It's really not part of this world. And everyone who's there is not sure if they're going to return to this world or if they're going to cross out of it into the next life. So everybody has a message that they desperately need to tell, love letter to write or something to confess. And Whitman goes there imagining that he is the healer, the savior, the do-gooder. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm Walt Whitman, I'm every man. And I imagine that identity being tested. There's at least one soldier in the space who stares at him hard and says, "Why are you really here? You just dropped everything? Do you have a family?" After all, he was a middle-aged gay man spending 3 years with a bunch of helpless 18-year-olds. So the question of what is selfless behavior, what did he want out of it, what was he looking for, is central to the piece, and it becomes about the relationship between him and this patient. The motion of crossing is, I think, central for Whitman in his great poem, Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. Something about the churning motion of the water as he crosses from Brooklyn to Manhattan on the steamboat, the vision of both shores, the act of passing between them, the light on the water, the presence of the other passengers, it becomes a sort of timeless or deja vu moment for him, that he feels the unity of human existence. He feels, in this moment, I am everybody who has ever passed between two shores on a boat. And you can imagine how that is, that moment of weightlessness between two human settlements is a slightly surreal one. And so the poem is a poem of revelation. You know, it begins with the line, "Flood tide below me, I see you face to face." It's like he sees the reflection of the activity of his own psyche in the rushing of the water. It's an extraordinary image to begin a poem on. And in the opera, Crossing Brooklyn Ferry is one of the only poems that I dared touch musically. I do set part of it to music. The motion of crossing has a lot of meanings. There's crossing through this life onto the next one, crossing from north into south and transgressing into enemy territory. There's the transgression of the erotic relationship that keeps threatening to take shape. And there's a crossing into a new level of self-awareness that I think Whitman reaches by the end of the opera. Hmm. The end of the opera, he doesn't die. Of course, he didn't die at the end of the Civil War. But he also stopped writing good poetry, I think, anyway. So there's a sort of death. It's almost like he graduated from needing poetry anymore. You know, as Frank O'Hara said, if you don't need poetry, bully for you. And so there's this curious summation of his life at the end of the war that I wanted to capture how he might have gotten there.
What is to say about, that's another subject, the loss of his muse, maybe, but how does that bear on it, do we think?
I think he had some encounters for which words were not sufficient, even if you're Walt Whitman. In the diaries, it's really powerful how often he says, "The things that I've seen have never been written in any book, and I don't know if I can write them or should," the experiences of the soldiers. And it's actually a horrifying moment for him because he sort of says, gosh, this has been happening through all of human history, this cycle of inexpressible suffering. And it's not in Homer. It's not in any, no one's ever captured it. And can I? Should I? And he keeps trying to and then backing away. And that is another moment in the opera. This soldier who is himself a sexually conflicted figure, in a strange kind of dreamlike seduction scene, the thing that he uses to goad Whitman into sort of transgressing is that he keeps saying, none of this should be remembered. You should not record. You should not try to record what you're seeing here, because it's evil. It's base. What you're seeing is humanity at its lowest.
This is the soldier who accuses him of some sort of, not assault, but violation.
Later,
right?
Yeah. It's a relationship of twists and turns.
But what does that tell you? I mean, I'm thinking, what is it that cannot or should not, must not be recorded? Is it the horror of these young amputees and men dying at 18 or 19 or whatever? Or is it, you know, something too sublime, a kind of an erotic sublimity that is beyond expressing too?
I think it's both for Whitman. I think almost equally in the diaries, he has these moments when he witnesses something really horrible, like a pile of limbs, or an act of bravery. He'll describe the act and then sort of recoil before the sublimity of it. And I hope in the opera he comes up against both kinds of experience.
Your work, Matt, and even your presence, I mean, sort of brings us to the kind of edge of Walt Whitman's imagination. Not many things do. Part of what he's doing, maybe the most obvious, is trying to put himself in a place to experience something personal and human in the middle of a industrial-scale war and deaths at a rate, certainly in this continent, that were just unimaginable before. I sense that you're also trying to get your human head around the kinds of deaths that would be vastly worse in nuclear or massive conflicts that are still possible today. I mean, maybe even daily worries. Make that connection. A little obvious, but
sure.
It's there.
The Civil War was, I think, the first moment, as you said, in American history that the famous Stalin line about one death being a tragedy and 10,000 being a statistic, that perspective became inescapable. That if you read that 10,000 of your countrymen died in a single field on a single day, how do you process it? And Whitman instinctively and almost prophetically, I think, saw the risk that this scale of atrocity posed for dehumanization, for global anonymity. In a way, that's the most relevant aspect. It's much more relevant than any kind of gay rights perspective. That's the element of crossing that feels most relevant to me for the world we live in, is that we don't live in enclosed communities anymore. We hear about our fellow billions on the planet. How do we process that experience? And Whitman's response to it was, I'm going to paint portraits of individuals. I'm just going to tirelessly give you portrait after portrait of young men, many of whom died that day. He's obsessive about it. He's a miniaturist. You don't think of Whitman as a miniaturist, but in the diaries, he is. And, you know, in the first draft of the opera, this is something that unfortunately didn't make it into the final version. The first draft of the opera was much more of an ensemble piece. It was much more about the portraits of person after person after person. But, you know, some of them were more interesting than others to me. So
what should we know about your process of wholesale revision here?
That it was ruthless, and that it was the stupidest and best decision I ever made, in the sense that we did a workshop of the piece last April, the first draft, and it went fine. You know, if the opera had been performed in that form, no one would have said, "Hey, mister, you didn't do your job." You know, it was an opera. But musically, as well as dramatically, I had only discovered the musical chain reaction in the harmony that felt to me like the real DNA of the piece. I only discovered it in the epilogue of the first draft. And so I finished the draft and thought, damn it, now I need to go back and inject this DNA into the entire piece. And it was exhausting, and I'm not sure I pulled it off, but the piece is stronger than it was in the first draft, for sure.
Talk about it without giving it away. You quote Walt Whitman raising the question, can I love intransitively? Can I love somewhere beyond lust and a physical attachment? How do we resolve that?
Can I love intransitively is actually a line from a poem I wrote my senior year. My thesis was a book of poems. And to go back to Mr. Bloom, I happened to show him that poem. This is long before I had thought about doing an opera that involved Whitman. And when he came to that line, Bloom said, "Oh, that's like Whitman. I'm always telling my students that the erotic verbs in Whitman are all intransitive." That was kind of the question of his life.
Of
Whitman's life, I think. Is it enough to create the persona of being every man and claiming to love everyone through your art and through the unconventional form of loving that his volunteer nursing was? And I think if you look at the most famous poems, you think that his answer is a resounding yes. You know, I'm one of the roughs. I'm comfortable with all forms of humanity. But if you look at the great poem, The Sleepers, you see that it's a major crisis for him. That poem begins with Whitman as the only wakeful presence in a sleeping world. And you can tell that he is saying, I'm never going to get any rest. I'm the eye of the poet. I'm the embodiment of the creative, searching spirit. Everybody else gets to rest. Everybody else gets to get married and stay in one place. I don't. So the question is both, you know, is art enough? How do you live? These are really deep questions for Whitman. And I don't think we get an answer from him ever.
We'll have more of Matt O'Coin. Ben Evatt, actor and artistic director of the Revived Poets Theater, takes us into the break with Walt Whitman's unsparing account of himself and his patients from one of the core poems of the collection Drum Taps. This is The Wound Dresser.
Bearing the bandages, water, and sponge, straight and swift to my wounded I go, where they lie on the ground after the battle brought in, where their priceless blood reddens the grass, the ground. or the rows of the hospital tent, or under the roofed hospital, to the long rows of cots up and down each side I return. To each and all, one after another, I draw near. Not one do I miss. An attendant follows, holding a tray. He carries a refuse pail, soon to be filled with clotted rags and blood, emptied and filled again. I onward go. I stop. With hinged knees and steady hand to dress wounds. I'm firm with each. The pangs are sharp, yet unavoidable. One turns to me, his appealing eyes. Poor boy. I never knew you. Yet I think I could not refuse this moment to die for you, if that would save you. On I go. Open doors of time, open hospital doors. The crushed head I dress, poor crazed hand, tear not the bandage away. The neck of the cavalryman with the bullet through and through I examine. Hard the breathing rattles, quite glazed already the eye, yet life struggles hard. Come, sweet death, be persuaded, O beautiful death, in mercy come quickly.
Ben Evett is our Whitman reader. Coming up, more words aspiring to the condition of music, more music aspiring to the force of words from Matt O'Coin's opera Crossing. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The other news of Walt Whitman this year is the republication, after 150 years, of the full book Drum Taps, the great literary monument of our Civil War, also the model of World War I poetry, even though the book was taken apart and remixed into Whitman's Leaves of Grass. Lawrence Kramer, composer and culture critic at Fordham University, has restored Drum Taps in a paperback edition of its own for the New York Review of Books, and he's helping us trace connections and crossings in the chaotic record of suffering and death at the hands of a modern war machine.
Drum Taps creates a sound world in which the Civil War comes alive not just in what one says about it, but in what one hears, in the sounds of the Civil War in America or of America at war. And I think that's one reason why over the years, Drum Taps has been probably the principal source of inspiration for composers setting Walt Whitman. It certainly was for me. My very first song cycle, which was written back in 1984, was to three Whitman poems.
Maybe 5 years ago, I interviewed C.K. Williams, the American poet, on precisely the music in Whitman. And as he said, probably not the first time anybody thought about it, that Whitman is singing. It's a kind of singing, the way poets control language and measure and make language move. It's the closest thing to music.
I think Whitman's verse forms very much appeal to that idea. He habitually refers to his poetry also as chant. And that idea of chanting goes very much together with the long, sinuous lines, the grammatical parallelism, the abundance that is so characteristic of Whitman's writing. So that you can imagine him reading his poetry aloud in a kind of quasi-musical manner.
So it makes all sorts of sense that Matt O'Coin would be making an opera out of this material.
I would think so. The material is intrinsically operatic. And oh, by the way, Whitman was a fanatical opera lover. So I think he could not have been more pleased by the prospect.
Lawrence Kramer, this subtle core of this work is somewhere in something Whitman is trying to tell us about war, which he says has never been recorded before, never been felt as he wanted to express it, even by Homer. And inside that riddle is something about the experience of men at war. And it's,
yes.
You refer to a sensuous resonance that overlaps the erotic. Can you unpack that for us?
Sure. The motivation for Whitman's publishing Drum Taps was his experience as a hospital volunteer in and around Washington, D.C. So when he saw the spectacle of these suffering soldiers and heard the sighs and groans that they emitted, it overwhelmed him. And he actually decided very quickly, I can't say on the spot, but he certainly resolved almost immediately that he was going to tend to these men. And that the tending that he gave them was extremely intimate. It was intimate both emotionally and psychologically, but also physically. He would hold the men. He would kiss the men. He would soothe them. Whitman was also a believer in animal magnetism, the notion that the bodies are pervaded with a magnetic force that can be directed by the hand of a healer. And so he would touch the soldiers in the hopes of literally healing them. So the entire experience for Whitman was intensely physical. And this overlapped with his own sense of the value of masculine affection. Now here we get into the very complicated area of Whitman's sexuality. John Ashbery once quipped to me that Whitman was the good gay poet, you know, playing on that old phrase, the good gray poet that Whitman's friend O'Connor put in the title of a book in the 1860s. And of course, that is both true and not true. Whitman's sexuality is very complicated. Clearly, he had very powerful, affectionate and physical ties to men. And one of his most original features as a poet and indeed as a human being in the 19th century context was to affirm these physically inflected ties, these sexually inflected ties, as sources of union, which is one of the reasons why he was such a passionate supporter of union and understood the war to be primarily about the ideal of union, which was to be conveyed through what he called adhesiveness.
Adhesiveness is his word, not yours, right?
Yes, it's his word. Right, exactly. Yeah.
He spoke, and you quote him, on the sweetest comradeship and human love threading its steady thread inside the chaos of this war scene.
Yes, he's very clear-sighted about that, that what is going to motivate him to do this work and to write this book is love. Love that he feels for the soldiers, that they feel for him, that they feel for each other. And indeed, if you go back to the original drum taps, there are a lot of little love poems in there, some of them among Whitman's most famous.
Which ones do you think specifically?
Well, in particular, Out of the Rolling Ocean, the Crowd. Mm. And it includes the lines, "I have traveled a long way merely to look on you, to touch you. For I could not die till I once looked on you, for I feared I might afterward lose you." And he goes on to say, "Now we have met, we have looked, we are safe. Return in peace to the ocean, my love. I, too, am part of that ocean, my love. We are not so much separated." So, you know, clearly, the passion that Whitman feels as a participant in these events and as a comrade of these men whom he helped nurse to health or helped die was, you know, pure and simple love for one man for another in the most intimate possible form.
Mm. And he's very self-consciously trying to write a hidden history, something that hasn't been told before.
That's right. You mentioned Homer earlier, and again, if you go back to this edition, Homer is a consistent background presence in this drum taps. There are many allusions to Homer and Homeric scenes. And what Whitman is actually doing, I think, is trying to establish himself as the anti-Homer, who strips the experience of war of its heroic apparatus and focuses rather sternly on its human costs. And in fact, the design of the book traces a movement from a kind of Homeric celebration of war fever to a chastened recognition that though the war may be necessary, though it may be necessary to make this blood sacrifice to secure the Union, the cost is extraordinarily high, and it needs someone to bear witness to it.
Mm. Whitman is considered prophetic. I'm thinking also Jonah Lehrer included him in his book about the Proustians of neuroscience, that Whitman and the body electric sort of got ahead of brain and body science in the 19th century. But I'm also just thinking of this sort of central depiction of the erotic and exquisite and suffering reality of men at war. I mean, in what ways does he anticipate what we're a long time figuring out about human sexuality?
Well, I think that Whitman was simply temperamentally attuned to certain modes of experience, which many of his contemporaries, most probably, certainly were aware of, but were very reluctant to talk about, very reluctant to put into language. And what Whitman understood was that these experiences, these dimensions of human life, the sexual, the sensory, the sensuous, the corporeal, the fleshly, that all of these things could only achieve their full impact on us, could only take their rightful place in culture if we're willing to talk about them and to celebrate them, and also, when it's appropriate, to mourn them. One of the key issues in the Lilacs Elegy, in fact, is that our living in our human bodies sometimes means that what we need more than anything else is death. And that's a very hard lesson. And one of the things that the Lilacs Elegy presses very hard on. But on the more affirmative side, the more life-affirming side, Whitman is anticipating later ways of speaking about experiences that had been put under a shadow because they were under a ban on speech. And this ban was informal. I mean, it's not that people did not understand the complexities and the intensities of human desire. It's just that the accustomed ways of talking about it were always too cautious. And I think also that the extremity of the war created conditions for the expression of those feelings, which would have been impossible in peacetime.
Hmm.
And you know, no one's about to celebrate that, least of all Walt Whitman. But he did find himself in an arena in which feelings that were normally kept on the margins of social and communal life were suddenly at the center. And he simply had the wit and the will and the courage to write about it.
Notice that everyone, starting with Whitman, observes the gravest devastation of the Civil War, not on the battlefields or in his hospital. He wrote, "I saw battle corpses, myriads of them, and the white skeletons of young men." But he notes, they were fully at rest. To this point of suffering, one of the most famously haunting poems in Drum Taps is set far from the battle, on a farm in an Ohio September, when a mother and family get a letter. Ben Evett is reading from "Come Up from the Fields, Father."
"Come up from the fields, Father. Here's a letter from our Pete. And come to the front door, Mother. Here's a letter from thy dear son. Lo, 'tis autumn. Lo, where the trees, deeper green, yellower and redder, cool and sweeten Ohio's villages with leaves fluttering in the moderate wind. Where apples ripe in the orchards hang, and grapes on the trellised vines. Smell you the smell of the grapes on the vines? Smell you the buckwheat where the bees were lately buzzing? Above all, lo, the sky so calm, so transparent after the rain, and with wondrous clouds. Below, too, all calm, all vital and beautiful, and the farm prospers well. Down in the fields all prospers well. But now from the fields come Father, come at the daughter's call, and come to the entry Mother, to the front door, come right away. Fast as she can she hurries, something ominous, her steps trembling. She does not dare to smooth her hair nor adjust her cap. Open the envelope quickly. Oh, this is not our son's writing, yet his name is signed. Oh, a strange hand writes for our dear son, oh, stricken mother's soul. All swims before her eyes, flashes with black. She catches the main words only. Sentences broken. Gunshot wound in the breast. Cavalry skirmish. Taken to the hospital. At present low, but will soon be better. Ah, now the single figure to me. Amid all teeming and wealthy Ohio, with all its cities and farms, sickly white in the face and dull in the head, very faint, by the jamb of a door leans. Grieve not so, dear mother, the just-grown daughter speaks through her sobs. The little sisters huddle round, speechless and dismayed. "See, dearest mother, the letter says Pete will soon be better." Alas, poor boy, he will never be better. Nor maybe needs to be better, that brave and simple soul. While they stand at home at the door, he is dead already, the only son dead. But the mother needs to be better. She, with thin form, presently dressed in black, by day her meals untouched, that at night fitfully sleeping, often waking, in the midnight waking, weeping, longing, with one deep longing. Oh, that she might withdraw unnoticed, silent from life, escape and withdraw, to follow, to seek, to be with her dear dead son.
I put it to young Matt O'Coin, creator of Whitman the Opera, just what he and we and Whitman have crossed by the end, and where we have crossed to. I mean, explain lightly, are we talking about a kind of transcendent love, an eros beyond eros, or what? What is he driving at that he wants to signal as possible?
He's reaching towards the way of life that he couldn't achieve in life, which was actually to settle down and be at home with people from all walks of life. He remained a wanderer throughout his life. So the realization of an intransitive eros is something that he posits as possible, but didn't live out.
And what's the sense of it? What's the sense of these crossings?
Maybe that they're ongoing, that nothing is resolved. When Whitman says, "I stop somewhere waiting for you," he is playing with temporality, essentially saying, I haven't achieved this in my life, maybe, but I've achieved it in my work, this perspective on life, this understanding of unity. Come on, catch up, America. You see that it's possible in my work, but you also see that it is an ideal. I think Whitman wrote knowing very well that the unity of existence, the sympathy that he shows for all walks of life, was not achieved or achievable in his lifetime, nor in ours. But he kind of posits a perspective and says, let's try and get there. I guess you could see my opera as a tiny sliver of such crossings and evolutions.
We're going out on more music from Crossing, the opera that's on stage this week at the Schubert Theater in Boston. Thank you, Matt O'Coin, and the American Repertory Theater for your generosity with time and attention and music for our show. Thank you, Lisa New, teacher of poetry in America, the MOOC from Harvard X. And thanks to Larry Kramer at Fordham for the 150th anniversary edition of Drum Taps in a bookstore or a library near you. Thanks and admiration to Ben Evett for reviving the Poets Theater and for the voice that brings Whitman alive in our ears. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, aside his comrades Max Larkin and Pat Tomeno. George Hicks is our maestro in the edit booth. Mary McGrath is our muse. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source.